Grand Canyon University's RN to BSN online degree program makes earning your bachelor's in nursing possible. Balance online coursework with local in-person clinicals to position yourself for potential leadership opportunities in the time you have from wherever you are, leaving room for what matters. Achieve your goals with your personalized plan and team behind you. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Visit gcu.edu.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Blogging Theology. Today, I'm delighted to talk again to Yusuf Oxton. You are most welcome, sir. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum salam. It's good to be back. Thank you, Paul.
It's great to see you again. It was actually last April that Yusuf first discussed his journey on Blogging Theology, and I thought it high time to invite him back on the channel to discuss his journey in more detail. And just to recap, Yusuf, also known as Russell Oxton, was an ordained Anglican priest, in other words, a Church of England clergyman for 12 years. After 5 years in parish ministry, he spent 7 years of ministry in healthcare, working as a hospital chaplain in East London and as a hospice chaplain in Kent. In 2010, he made the life-changing decision to embrace Islam and became a Muslim. Since then, he worked for a Quaker charity in London before retraining as an English language teacher. He married his Nubian Egyptian Yemeni wife and moved to Cairo. And after a year in Egypt, he moved to the Sultanate of Oman, where he has lived for and worked for over 10 years with his wife and two children. Now, in his own words, he once said, and I quote, "Upon my embracing Islam, I realized the internal shift within me was spiritual, religious, and intellectual. It was an unexpected revolution of the heart and mind. Initially, I was a reluctant convert, trying my very best to remain within the Christian church I had loved and served for so long. However, we can only deny Allah's call for so long. Since my Shahada in 2010, the deepening and widening of my understanding, both of the religion and the world, goes on. I continue to be humbled by so many Muslims I meet on a daily basis. Alhamdulillah," he writes. End quote. A beautiful quote there, which you've given me permission to share. So can I just begin by asking you a bit more about your rather unusual upbringing, which involved a lot of travel?
So thank you, Paul. It's great to be back again, and thank you for inviting me. So I had the fortune, if you like, of growing up. My father happened to be in the initially in the British Army, so we traveled quite extensively. I've lived in Oman as a child, so subhanAllah, I've come back to a country that I'd experienced as a child. I've also lived in Spain and Germany and many parts of the UK. And I think I'm quite grateful, in a sense, for my parents, who were not particularly religious, but we had a very much an open, tolerant understanding of other cultures, other religions, right, other ways of living. And I think looking back, I'm grateful for that early upbringing, because I think that allowed me then through time to be exposed and to learn from other traditions, not just the Christian tradition.
Mm-hmm. So now you've been living in Oman for how many years?
10 years.
10 years. Extraordinary. Now, tell us a bit more about your theological training and the influences in your thinking theologically.
Yeah, so I think in my theological training to be an Anglican, a Church of England priest, I trained in Birmingham, which, of course, as you know, is an incredible city, a multicultural city where there are many cultures, many religions living side by side. And whilst I was there, I belonged to the interfaith group. So we would visit Sikh gurdwaras, mosques, synagogues, and so on. And I really enjoyed that interface with people from different religions as a Christian. And of course, there I had many tutors, many great tutors at the time, one of whom was Robert Beckford, who is quite a well-known black theologian based in Birmingham. And he really challenged me for the first time to look at alternative narratives and alternative theologies, particularly from a Black perspective. And that really challenged me to really look again. And one of my favorite phrases of unlearning in order to learn is to experience, to experience the other. And so as a Christian, I began to really look again at my preconceived ideas and beliefs. And that was further challenged when I traveled to South India. As part of my training, I went to Tamil Nadu Theological Seminary in Madurai in Tamil Nadu. And there, of course, I was introduced to the whole idea of liberty.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Creation theology. Most in particular, looking at Dalit theology. And there again, I had some great theologians who taught me, including a German theologian called Bas Verlinger. And again, quite a well-known liberation theology teacher at the time. Again, we explored the experience of Christians and others of color, those who are not white, who are not Western, And looking really at their experience of being a Christian in a minority country, but also looking at those, particularly a large number of Hindus from the lower castes and the Dalits, of course, who turned to Christianity and Islam as a way of reclaiming their sense of identity and their sense of worth. And so that also really began to settle in my heart and mind many years before I became a Muslim.
Extraordinary. You mentioned you were at Birmingham. Did you ever come across Professor John Hick, the famous Christian philosopher? He was, I think,
at Birmingham. Yes, I did. I studied at Birmingham University. I did my Bachelor of Divinity there. So I was in a very well-known and very vibrant theology department. This was in the late 90s. So again, that was a really good experience, having seminars with some really interesting theologians.
I mentioned him because he's a Christian theologian. He was very much appreciative of other faith traditions, Islam. So sadly, he's no longer with us, but I benefited from his books in the past. So you mentioned to me, I think you had a close Bangladeshi Muslim friend. Adina, what impact did she have on your, what life-changing impact did you have on your life?
Yes, so the irony, of course, is after the wonderful experience of Birmingham, I ended up as a curate, as a newly ordained priest, in the very conservative, with a small C, a market town of Andover in Hampshire.
Oh, gosh.
where it was very different, of course, from Birmingham. Yeah. And I was happened to be working alongside an evangelical vicar at the time, and so we would have different opinions about a number of points of theology, but the irony is, in that context, I happened to meet by chance a young Bangladeshi woman. She came to the UK at the age of 4, and we met. And really, that became a very life-changing experience for me over about a 3-year period, where we became close. And I remember watching her pray, watching her read Quran. She would have her Quran above a wardrobe, high up, as a token of respect, bound in beautiful cloth. And I remember one incident where a member of her family had passed away in Bangladesh. And she got out of her Quran and she read the Quran and she made dua. And she was crying. It was a very intimate moment. And I really began to recognize the experience of somebody of another faith and how profound and how deep that faith went. And also, for the first time, being alongside a person of color, and how that really plays out in so many micro moments of racism and Islamophobia, which certainly exists in the West. And so she taught me a great deal, and I'm forever grateful for her.
Oh, that's amazing. Are you still in touch with her today?
Sadly not. Many years have passed, but I remain thankful for really what was the first moment of getting up close and personal to Islam.
Okay. Now, the next stage of your life was your time as a hospital chaplain in East London. So what is a chaplain? How does that differ from, say, a vicar or a curate, as you said you were before that?
Yeah, so I left parish ministry and I was employed by the NHS, licensed by the bishop. And I worked full time in a very busy general hospital in East London. And that really allowed me a great deal of freedom to offer religious, spiritual, pastoral care to anyone really who requested it. So that would be patients, staff, and patients' families. And so there was a real element of offering specifically religious care, for example, the sacraments, but also being a listening ear to patients as they tried to explore issues around their own illness, a tremendous amount of social issues living and working in East London. And I know it's an overused phrase, but I did feel that I was at the cutting edge in many ways of inner city urban ministry and working in healthcare at the time. And again, that's when I, over a 5-year period, I began to question much more deeply about systemic problems around living in this very much aggressive, consumerist, neoliberal capitalist system.
Very materialist. It often strikes materialist, doesn't it? This system we live in the West.
Very much so. And I was meeting on a daily basis so many people who had fallen through that system, who really had even fallen through the welfare system. And so they were at the mercy of the kindness of strangers. And so over a slow period of time, I began to question how our society operates and the assumptions that we have around democratic society and the illusion in many ways of democracy. And I was seeing the victims of this very aggressive capitalist system. And so again, without exploring Islam at the time, I just became increasingly more aware and frustrated that by remaining in this system as a chaplain, I was actually colluding in this system rather than helping. And I would have this phrase that I would often tell my colleague, that I was extremely busy and I was getting burnt out. And I was running around putting plasters on people's axe wounds. That's how it felt as a chaplain, that there was profound and deep inequality that I was experiencing within this setting. And so I began to really question how Western societies operate.
So do you think the Western church, the Western Christian church, is somehow assimilated into this system as well?
Yeah. So again, I began to see where do I fit in as a priest, and where does the institutional church fit into this society? And again, over time, I began to feel that the church was assimilating, was complicit in this very unequal system of economic and political governance. And I began to feel that the church was not really challenging, or not challenging loudly enough, this assumption that this is the system that we should operate within. And so I almost felt like the church had almost succumbed or bowed down to this very aggressive liberal secular system, and was no longer, I think, of any relevance to a lot of people. And that's why I think many people have moved away from the institutional church and looked elsewhere for meaning. And as you and I know, I think the numbers of young people, especially who are looking towards Islam in the West, is increasing quite rapidly. And I think what they're looking for is a depth and a richness of spirituality and tradition that has remained, on the whole, remained true to its heart. And so I often feel like the Christianity, dare I say, of the Church of England has become what I would call an anemic Christianity, a Christianity which no longer has the force of what they would call the good news of the gospel. I think has been lost by this overbearing, crushing agenda now that we have in the UK and other countries, a very much aggressive secular agenda with capitalism at its heart.
But is it not the case that these values you're rightly concerned about are now encroaching upon Muslim countries and the East in general? It's not just confined to the geographical borders of Britain, is it? It's becoming global.
Yeah, I spent a year in Egypt, and I've been here 10 years. And I do find, particularly in the Gulf, I'm here in the south of Oman. I'm not far from Yemen. But even here, I think with satellite TV, with globalization, social media, I do find now that all-pervasive notion of West is best is encroaching within society in Eastern countries, not just Islamic countries, but I think the East generally. And I do worry for the future when I do see that the incredible treasure and tradition of Eastern countries, Muslim countries, somehow being watered down or being consumed by this consumerism, the building of shopping malls, and the you know explosion of social media has positives, but also many negatives. And so I do feel in some ways many countries in the East are sleepwalking into this Western consumerism without really, really, truly critiquing this system that they are now adopting.
But is there not also another current at work here, and this is more to do with more recent events in Gaza and the genocide, yes, and the what many people, particularly in the global south and in the West too now, are seeing as a complete double standards, that the West talks about the international rule-based order and human rights and democracy and so on, whilst giving political economic cover to what's going on in Gaza and actually supplying weapons that are killing people. I mean, I saw the terrible footage of an unarmed group of people with holding a flag of surrender in Gaza yesterday, and the man holding the flag was shot by the Israelis, and this was all filmed by ITN, a British camera crew, and our government was asked to condemn this as a crime, and they refused to do so. And I just mentioned that one isolated as emblematic of the situation, that although you're talking about the encroaching materialism and consumerism, certainly the shopping malls and the glamorous West allegedly, but is there not also another stream here where people are waking up in a particularly vivid way now with social media, because of social media, which is causing this Westernization, but nevertheless now giving us real-time access to what's actually happening on the ground. And so there's a counteracting force, a disillusionment with the West, as well as an attraction to the West. So it's a bit more complicated.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And I mean, I do, and I felt for quite a long time now, I think there is this growing disconnect with governments, not just Western governments, I hasten to add. I think also governments in the East and in the Arab nations as well. I think there is a growing disconnect between government decisions and the citizens on the street. And I think we are seeing this over the catastrophe of what's happening in Gaza and Palestine as a whole, in the West Bank as well.
Yes.
That we are seeing a growing awareness among citizens of all cultures and all faiths, different parts of the world, really seeing injustice for what it is. Mm-hmm. And I think the frustrating thing for so many of us is this disconnect between the government speak of so many nations and what the person on the street is feeling when we see the unfolding tragedy, the unfolding genocide that's happening in Palestine that we have been aware of for decades, of course, but is now under the full glare of the TV cameras and social media across the globe. And I think this has brought about a reawakening of the political situation of Palestine, but also I think a spiritual reawakening as people begin to explore Islam and begin to witness the incredible iman, the incredible faith of a people under extreme conditions.
Exactly that. There is a revival of interest in Islam in the West because of this, particularly amongst young people who are just, as we all are, amazed at the great faith, the fortitude of people under extreme conditions, extreme oppression and injustice, and their faith is shining through. And this speaks to the reality of Islam, of course.
Yes.
But just coming back to embracing Islam yourself, you had a status before in Britain as of privilege or of leadership, and then you become a Muslim in a different landscape. Is there a sense still that you have white privilege as a Muslim? Is this something that you're aware of? And if so, how does it play out in your life?
Yes, it's interesting. It's something that isn't really spoken about, but certainly my experience on embracing Islam as a white, blue-eyed British guy.
Blue eyes. I wasn't sure. I've got blue eyes. Yeah, you mentioned it. You are.
Yes. Okay. And I think yes, I was treated with a great deal of joy and respect.
Mm.
There was even a sense of people wanting to use me as a trophy, as this person who had embraced Islam. Yeah. And also coming here now in Egypt and now in Oman, I think it's fair to say that my experience as a white male embracing Islam may be quite different from somebody with brown or black skin.
How so? How would you characterize that difference then? What is this?
I think I'm treated with a great deal of almost reverence. I am invited into people's homes. People are genuinely overjoyed that a Western white man has become a Muslim. And I think racism, this subtle and not so subtle racism, I think shoots through all cultures, all religions. And although many Arabs will deny it, I think racism certainly exists within the Arab world as it does in the West. And so I find my experience is quite different to many others. I'm married to a black hijabi woman. She's been a Muslim all her life. And particularly in London or in the UK, through being alongside her, I experienced the subtle and microaggressions that she would have to face on a weekly basis, being number one, a black woman and also an hijabi woman, that Islamophobia and racism that can often be experienced by people of color really again taught me my own unconscious privilege which I have carried around with me all my life and never really questioned. Mm-hmm. So my relationship with her has also allowed me to, again, relearn what I believe to be everybody's experience of the world, which, of course, it isn't. So I am very much aware of my white privilege now, certainly as a Muslim. And of course, as you said, most Muslims live outside of Europe, outside of the US. And so, again, having experienced Muslims in East London, in Morocco, in Egypt, and in Oman, I have been humbled, really, by their level of generosity, their level of insight. And they're often not given a voice in society, within the media, particularly the Western media. We have a very selective news covering in the West. And I'm certainly seeing that now with the coverage of Palestine.
Yes.
So I think all of that has allowed me to see my privileged status and position as a Muslim. But of course, when I converted or reverted, I lost that sense of leadership, that sense of status as a Christian leader and as a priest. And I became like a child. And I think that's the experience of so many converts to Islam, particularly in the West, that we are entering into a culturally different landscape. We're having to learn again. And I did feel like a child trying to fumble my way through this new theological and cultural landscape. And even living in London, I was in East London and I was surrounded by many mosques. But of course, my experience would be, which mosque do I go to? And would I go, for example, to the Ghanaian mosque or the Turkish mosque or the Bangladeshi mosque?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so there wasn't really a place where I felt really comfortable as a white British convert. The only place that came close would be London Central Mosque.
Regent's Park Mosque. Yeah, that's where I said my jihad. That's where I go to. Yeah, it's much more multicultural, I think.
Yes, much more international, also more Arab, I have to say. And so that allowed me to see a much more international community. But I think certainly for me, in those early days and years, it can be difficult for new Muslims to really know where they belong. But I think that's now beginning to change as there are more British converts to Islam. And I think over time, and even now, I think there is a new identity that's beginning to emerge of
this new identity. What form does this take, this emerging British Muslim identity, do you think?
I think it's a convergence of adopting the Islamic religion and trying to navigate that whilst living and being brought up in very much a Western society with liberal values and trying to, and of course you have issues of fashion and literature and music and art and how one begins to navigate that and incorporate aspects into one's faith. And so I do feel there is beginning to be a distinctive British Islamic identity that's forming. And I think that will increase over time when we also begin to see, I think, emerging scholars who have come out of that landscape. Yeah. We have the likes of Dr. Abdul Hakim Murad, of course, who's very famous. But I think over time there will be more who have been brought up in the UK, studied in the UK, who will then emerge, I think, as leading scholars from the West, not just the UK, but other Western countries as well. And I think that could be quite an exciting time for this growing Western community of converts.
Yeah, I've been very impressed with the caliber of the emerging ulama, Muslim yes. scholars in Britain and in America, actually, often centered around places like Cambridge Muslim College or Zaytuna College yes. And other centers of intellectual excellence. And some very impressive individuals I had the privilege to speak to. The people who are very grounded in the Islamic tradition, the traditional sciences, as well as very literate in the Western yes. tradition.
Yes.
And they are bilingual in that sense, completely at home in both traditions. And before that was quite rare. I mean, you mentioned Abdul Hakim Rad, Tim Winter certainly was. And before him, there was Guy Eaton. These were individuals quite exceptional. But now I'm seeing a whole group of people, you know, pursuing yeah. academic excellence. And they have a very nuanced relationship with the West. They're not in any way assimilating in an uncritical way to secularism at all, far from it. They have this robust position, but they're nuanced and they know yes. how to speak the language of the West, whilst at the same time remaining true to their tradition, their Islamic tradition. So I'm very optimistic, actually, in this perhaps one area, not many other areas at the moment, for the future of, and it's not just British Muslim identity, but for other aspects of Europe as well. It's good. I like that early on you said this phrase you came up with, unlearn in order to learn. I like that, that I can certainly identify with having to unlearn, and that's something I've had to confront recently when I've been traveling a lot abroad. Yes. And I've noticed because I speak to other Muslims who are not white, and their experience of travel going through immigration passport control. And it's very different for them, actually. And this is always what they say, that they get stopped and ask questions and it takes a time. And even going to the Muslim world, you know, and I've not experienced that. I really haven't, whether it be to the States or to the Arab world. I'm usually just kind of straight through, you know, a couple of routine questions. In 30 seconds, I'm through. And that's not the experience of non-white Muslims. Yes. And this for me has awakened me to the unofficial but real racial hierarchy that operates everywhere, even though officially yes. doesn't exist.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, they're just talking to people in conferences and hotels and so on who I met, and extraordinary stories, and they are consistent, they're always the same. So I can't deny this is factual, because it's just the testimony is so universal.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, that goes wholly against, of course, the teachings of Islam, and you know, you mentioned your experience, and here's just one experience where some years back here in Oman, I happened to be passing a very large wedding that happens, and here in this culture, the weddings are celebrated by the men outside in huge marquees. There can be dancing, traditional dancing. And so I was with my small son at the time, and we stopped our car and we went over to have a look. And I was immediately invited into the large tent, given food and treated with great respect. At the same time, it just so happened that my Bawab, the young Bangladeshi man who looked after our building, happened to walk by. And I saw him and I waved and he came over and I invited him to sit next to me. And clearly for many at the wedding, this was not something that should have happened. And so there was this awkward moment where he was ushered out of the tent. And that made me feel deeply uncomfortable as a Muslim man, understanding the Islamic notion of equality, regardless of color, of course. And so that's just one example. Yeah. And as you say, there are countless others that we can experience. Again, in Egypt, in Cairo, we have the Bawab, which is in every block of flats. Somebody who's generally poor, who looks after the building, lives in a small flat at the bottom. And I was invited to sit with his family for tea, and as the people came into the building, into their flats, they looked down at me on the floor eating with this family, and they were quite frankly shocked and horrified that I should be sitting with this family. And so that makes you feel uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And I think certainly within many countries, although they will be quick to deny it, I think racism pervades all cultures and all religions, and Islam sadly is no exception.
Mm-hmm. No, and I think without going off the point too much, I become more aware of the West supremacist and even white supremacist attitude when it comes to non-white peoples like the Palestinians, comparing that with, say, Ukrainians, who are perceived as one of us, i.e. white Europeans, and the way they have been welcomed into our homes here in Britain as refugees, when it comes to Syrians and others, is a very different sense. And of course, officially, there's no utterance, but the difference in treatment is palpable and obvious, and it's not normally remarked upon officially at all, but it's a big reality. Yes.
And of course, you know, there's this huge colonial legacy. And again, I began to be introduced at Theological College with this whole history and European colonial legacy, which continues to be imprinted upon the psyches of white and black across the world. And I do find it incredibly rich when I see the likes of the British government making these holier-than-thou statements on various parts of the world without really understanding their own part and their own legacy in some of the issues that we face today.
Yeah, I felt that a bit nauseating, particularly in the media, the more conservative media that mock the idea or deride the idea that there should be any issues with colonialism today. It's sort of seen as a left-wing fetish. It's not taken seriously at all, but it's very much living in reality. And the other thing to do, again, a very specific example with for example, the British Museum, this great in the heart of London, which I remember a year or two ago had an LGBT flag proudly flying from its top of the building, you know, so it identifies with this woke cause. I mean, that's not my point about the wokeness. The point is that the building is stuffed full of colonial treasures. Most of them were taken when Britain was a colonial power, Egyptian things particularly, obelisks and whatnot, which is taken, you know. And there's a sense of this bizarre juxtaposition of wokery on the one hand and colonial arrogance, and that we're keeping these goods. Why? Because, well, they're in our property. We're going to keep them forever. Because the reason is often given, well, we're taking good care of them here. We're not sure they'll be taken good care of back in Egypt, which is deeply offensive, particularly as they just built this huge, whopping, great big museum in Cairo to house these things in the first place. State of the art as well. Anyway, that's another subject. But you get this kind of weird kind of juxtaposition of kind of left-wing trendiness and sort of colonial supremacism operating at the same time. Very English.
Absolutely. The double standards. I think as a Muslim, certainly you really begin to see those double standards much, much more deeply. And, you know, they talk of tolerance and liberalism, but I think it's tolerance on their grounds, within their own boundaries and within their own standards. And so I do find that sometimes deeply hypocritical and frustrating at times when I do see that that double standard in a whole range of issues. Yeah. And I think what I've experienced in the Islamic world is, again, this sense of community, cohesion, collective responsibility over individual responsibility. Right. And that's one of the big differences I found having lived in Morocco, Egypt, Oman, is there's a much deeper sense of my actions have a bearing upon the wider community and the wider society. Mm. So that overrides my individual desires. Mm. And I've come to really respect that because it creates a stability and a peace and a cohesion, which I think has been lost in the West.
Yes.
And so I have found that living here. One example would be, of course, the idea of alcohol.
Right.
It's very difficult for me to drink alcohol here. I can if I go to a five-star hotel, but alcohol is not visible. Now, I may enjoy drinking alcohol. I may enjoy it. I want it. But as a Muslim, it's the idea that I will forego what I like for the health of the wider, larger community, not only my family, but the society. And I think that's one really good example of collective responsibility. I have a responsibility for my own self, but also for my brothers and sisters in the wider community. Mm-hmm. And so I will forego something like this for the wider good. And I think that's a notion that isn't really understood within Western society.
No, there's obviously, you know, much more emphasis on the individual choice in a very kind of selfish, egotistical sense. You know, I want. And other people sort out the consequences of my actions. If alcohol is freely available, but let the weak go to the wall. You know, it's their responsibility. It's a terrible attitude of there's no sense of social collective responsibility for the general common good. It's if they can't handle the alcohol, that's their problem. We must all have free access to it. Well, whatever happened to looking, loving your neighbour and caring for the social?
Yes.
It's not fair.
I think there's this, even now with the encroaching Western values arriving here, there is still this very deep sense of being accountable to God.
Right.
And you really feel it here, that my actions are not only accountable in this life, but will it be accountable in the next? And I think that's very, very much still alive and well in this part of the world. And I've experienced it here. So again, my actions, they might be hidden by others, but they will be one day known and revealed. And I think that also creates an incredible sense of stability and peace and cohesion. And it is extraordinary here, the level of sense of belonging to the wider society and having a part to play in that.
And this is something that the West, of course, really needs to learn from and benefit from for its own good, actually, and not arrogantly assume it's superior to the rest of the world. But it has these immense treasures, these riches, spiritual riches, and social riches that it can I think they once did exist in Europe. This is not alien, they're part of the European heritage. So we're in a sense encouraging the West to remember its own heritage, but also in Islamic form, which is a purified form of spirituality. But nevertheless, it's similar. So this is something the West really needs to, I guess it comes with the humility and willing to listen. And we're not very good at that in the West, as we're busy lecturing the world about, you know, the way the world.
Yes. And going back to my time as a healthcare chaplain, what I came to understand as well is you cannot replicate human compassion with systems. And so what I've found in the West, and certainly within the NHS, and I met some amazing, amazing professionals working within the NHS and indeed within the church, some really holy people wishing to serve and help society. But what I've found in the West is, as Christianity has been in serious decline, what we see now is very much secular systems of governance, of welfare, that are there to support and offer care to the individual. But what I think has happened is we have been enslaved by the systems. So one example would be my wife's experience of giving birth in the UK and giving birth here in Oman. Two very different experiences. The UK had the technology, had the staff and so on, but there was a lack of compassion. Here, less technology, less advanced, but the care that she received from her Sudanese midwife and others was outstanding. And so there, I feel, is the difference. So you can have all the systems in place, all the pathways of care in place. But what happens is you can end up ticking the boxes.
Yes.
And not really caring for the individual. And so what would happen here, if somebody was experiencing misfortune, organically, the local community would come together, gather together, and offer financial or practical help to that person. Mm-hmm. And it would happen almost organically. I think that's been lost in certain Western societies. Yeah. So we have systems in place. We have the welfare system, but it's administered with a great deal of, I would say, malice or uncaring attitude. And I experienced that when I was working for the Quakers. I was working for a groundbreaking charity offering care to those who could not afford a funeral for their loved ones.
Right.
And so I would assist them as they rang the government's helplines, applying for loans, a government loan to bury their loved one. And often we would meet very uncaring voices at the other end of the line who lacked real compassion and understanding of that person's situation. And so, again, over time, I began to see these cracks in systems and in society in the West that I began to question. And I think the Islamic world has something very precious about this sense of caring for your brother and sister. And that happens organically out of one's faith tradition. And that's still very much present here, which I value.
Amazing. That's deeply fascinating. Particularly the way your wife experienced, giving birth in those two very different contexts. Extremely telling, actually.
Yes. I did find that. And as a chaplain, I had this incredible privilege of entering the space with a huge amount of freedom, I have to say, to offer that presence, that non-judgmental presence, to be alongside someone often in the most difficult periods of immense grief or shock, and being that bridge between the NHS professionals and the patient. And I think chaplains of all faiths have this immense privilege of being there and being a voice often to those who feel like they don't have a voice. And I did see that time and time again within the NHS, an amazing institution, incredible people working within it, working almost to breaking point. And I know that I experienced burnout towards the end, because I think the system itself is crumbling. And like governments around the world, I think the status quo cannot continue for much longer, because I think there is a groundswell of dissatisfaction, frustration, dare I say anger now, where we are not being listened to for a whole variety of issues.
Yes, I was just thinking, actually, that's potentially, it was a different subject, and I don't want to go there now, but. I just read in the paper yesterday, a leading forecaster was saying that they're predicting in the next year the rise of right-wing populist politics in Europe as a response to this perceived lack of the system not working and listening to people's needs. With Trump almost certainly going to be elected to the White House. Countries like Germany and France and others, I think predominantly most countries are predicted to either elect or have close second runners. People of the so-called populist right in Germany, for example. We have Geert Wilders in Holland, who is the prime minister-elect, of course, Italy, etc. So although perhaps you're pointing to real problems, the way they are, the solutions that are being sought for them in Europe, at least, may not be very friendly to minorities in Europe.
No, yeah, and I do think there is a growing vacuum, really, that allows the likes of Trump, as you say, to no doubt, and I'm sure it's going to be reelected, and also, of course, Biden's perceived weakness over Palestine, I think, has really frustrated and angered a lot of Muslims in America, who I think will no longer vote for him, and I think it's a sign, the sadness of our times, when we have the choice of Trump or Biden, or Rishi Sunak or Sir Keir Starmer. I think it tells a lot, really, of the state of our politics, where we have the leader of a Labour Party refusing to call for a total ceasefire in Palestine is going to give, it's going to do him electoral damage. There's no question. Mm-hmm. But of course, who do we vote for? So, you know, there's no clear alternative.
No, exactly.
And I think there is this vacuum. The extreme right certainly will take its place. And I think for those of us very much against this, we need to raise our voices more, certainly.
Indeed. Drawing perhaps to a close, yes. We don't have unlimited time. Are there books and resources that you might want to talk about that you found useful, actually?
I think you're going to put a list underneath the video when it comes up. And it's quite an eclectic list, not all by Muslims, I have to say. But yeah, I found a whole number of resources really good. I particularly mention a book which is not really well known, which is The Butterfly Mosque by G. Willow Wilson. She is a young American woman who traveled to Cairo and she embraced Islam. And it's partly a love story between her and her Egyptian husband, but it's an incredibly articulate exploration of what it means for a Western person to embrace Islam and how one adopts that theologically, but also culturally. And she explores these difficulties of interfacing between Western upbringing and a very Eastern Islamic culture of being in the center of Egypt. That's a really good book to read. And some people might raise their eyebrows because I put down there a movie to watch, The Last Samurai.
Is this the Tom Cruise film?
It is. It's quite old now. I think it's about 20 years old. Mm. But I think that's a really beautiful film that explores somebody coming from the West with their preconceived ideas and notions of superiority.
The Tom Cruise character.
Yes, yes. And he enters this traditional Japanese culture. Mm. And it explores how his construct and his narratives and his prejudices are slowly dismantled by his experience.
Yes, yes.
And I think that's a beautiful film exploring how assumptions can be challenged and how you can unlearn in order to learn and how he finally embraces this new culture. I think it's a really beautiful film exploring those issues. So there are some good books. There's a new, a fairly new book exploring the experience of being a white person within Islam, and that's The Invisible Muslim by Medina Whiteman. And she talks about this white privilege and being an incognito Muslim. When I walk down the street, nobody knows, of course, that I'm a Muslim. Here in Oman, they will assume I'm not.
Yes.
And so there can be an element of surprise, shock, or joy when people realize that I'm a Muslim. Well, for hijabi women, of course, they don't have that incognito privilege. They are there as soon as they open the door. And that brings expectations. It brings difficulties as well as opportunities, I think. So that's also a good book to read. And of course, there are many others. I'm a great fan of the author Leila Abu Leila. She is a Scottish Sudanese writer. And she wrote a beautiful collection of stories called Elsewhere Home, which explores the experience of second and third generation Muslims living in the UK. And I find her writing to be extremely tender, moving and insightful, exploring themes around identity, of exploring where one is in the world. Certainly as a second or third generation Muslim arriving in the UK. She's a really good writer that I would recommend. She's written a number of novels and short stories. So I would recommend her as well. There is a recent novel, again, not by a Muslim, Babel by R.F. Kuang, which is set in Oxford University in the 1800s. And that explores the experience of a young Chinese boy arriving from China, enters into this very precious ivory tower world of Oxford, and how over time he begins to question the entire establishment of which he now belongs. And that's an incredibly good novel that explores it. And one of the protagonists is Muslim. And so that explores, again, assumptions made about foreigners in the Western world. It's also a very good book.
I noticed you included a book by Chomsky, Noam Chomsky, called Gaza in Christ.
Yes.
I mean, is that particular one on that particular subject? Are there many books on Gaza?
There are many. And I mean, he's somebody that I've read over many years, long before I was even a Muslim. It's a little bit dated now, but I think he explores the origins of this and the history of this crisis in great detail, and also writes about the daily humiliations and the daily oppression, really, of a people that has gone on for decades. And you mentioned the experience of black and brown people arriving at airports around the world, but of course Palestinians experience that at checkpoints every day of their lives. I think many people are only waking up to the history of that part of the world now through this unfolding catastrophe that's happening for the Palestinians.
Indeed. Well, perhaps we'll leave it there, but thank you very much indeed for your time. And I will put a list of the books and resources that you've sent me in the description below, so you can read these amazing works. The Last Samurai film, it's definitely worth watching. And also a YouTube video, Finding Joe, which you can discover yourself as well.
Yeah, that's not particularly Islamic, but I think this notion by Joseph Campbell of the power of myth, and this idea he had of the hero's journey certainly helped me on my journey to become a Muslim. Because when I look at his idea of the hero's journey, I see my path of realization from becoming a Christian priest, and then embarking upon this great unknown journey of embracing Islam. And so I find his idea of the hero's journey really helpful. In this particular documentary, it was very useful for me as I made that decision to become a Muslim, despite the great anxiety, the voices telling me to do otherwise, but remaining true to myself. A really good documentary.
Fantastic. Well, that's amazing. Thank you so much indeed, Yusuf, for your time.
Thank you so much, Paul.
It's been an immense pleasure and an education to hear your very interesting journey, and I'm sure many will benefit from it. So thank you so much. Until next time, salam alaikum.
Thank you so much. Alaikum salam. Thank you, Paul.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.